Well, a few Sunday evenings ago, I preached from Psalm 104, a harvest-related sermon. Prior to that, on the morning of Aaron's baptism, I preached from Psalm 103. And I wouldn't want Psalm 102 to feel left out, and so that's where we're going to go this morning, just for a one-off sermon. Psalm 102, I guess, isn't as well known, probably, as those other two that come after it, but it does have one standout section. It's the section that I immediately think of if I ever hear Psalm 102 mentioned, and that's verses 25 to 28, the concluding section of the psalm. There's something very elegant and epic almost about this ending to the psalm, and it's going to be, in a particular way, certainly not an exclusive way, we're going to go through the whole of the psalm, but it's going to be, in a particular way, our focus this morning. Those four verses really are our text. And while it's good and proper to admire the poetry then that we have in verses 25 to 28, the language and imagery which lend to those verses their grandeur, I want us to do more than that. I want us to ask, apart from a powerful piece of writing, what do we have here? Indeed, what ultimately do we have here when everything else is stripped away? To put it simply, what lies at the heart of these four verses? What lies at the heart of this, our text? And I want to suggest then two things in answer to that question. And first of all, a conviction attained with difficulty. That's what we have at the heart of this, our text. A conviction attained with difficulty. And we shall spend longer on this point this morning. Listen carefully for a moment to these words from Sinclair Ferguson. He says, "Christian people need to learn that we live the whole of our Christian lives between two fixed dates. Those two fixed dates are not the day of my birth and the day of my death. Those are not the two dates that dominate the Christian's life. They may dominate non-Christians' lives, but the two dates that dominate the Christian life are date number one, I live looking back to Christ's finished work for my salvation, and date number two, I live looking forward to the day of his coming again in majesty and glory." He concludes, "When that calendar is in my mind, it has a dramatic impact on my life." And I think Sinclair Ferguson's words there help us to understand the struggle which the writer of Psalm 102 is experiencing. I know the details aren't applicable to this psalmist. He, of course, couldn't look back to the finished work of Christ the way that Sinclair Ferguson describes. But it's that more general point I'm interested in, that there are two alternative calendars which the believer can have in his or her mind. One calendar is centered upon my birth and my life. The other calendar is centered upon God's program of salvation. Those are the two alternatives. And this psalmist then struggles to hang calendar number two, the salvation program calendar, on the wall of his mind. He struggles to pull down calendar number one. He struggles not to think primarily in terms of his own life, as though its dates rather than salvation's dates are the supremely important ones. And then there's a further ingredient in the psalmist's struggle that we need to appreciate. He's profoundly conscious of God's eternity, the eternal nature of God's existence. That's a truth of which he is keenly aware, which might sound like a very good thing. Surely God's different attributes, his different characteristics, are exactly what all believers should constantly be thinking about, including this attribute, God's eternity. It's great, surely, to feel the weight of that truth in a very real way, as I'm saying the psalmist does here. And yes, it is. It is good to be conscious of the truth of God's eternity, but only if you have the right one of those two calendars in your head. Let's get into the psalm at this point, and I'll try to show you what I mean. Look, first of all, at verses 1 to 12. And it's immediately clear, then, that the psalmist is experiencing some kind of major crisis. He refers in verse 2 to the day of his distress. Indeed, he senses that death is imminent. Whether that means he's suffering a serious illness or whether it's the enemies he mentions in verse 8 that pose the mortal threat to him, we don't know. But either way, he clearly feels that he's but a hair's breadth from the grave. And that thought is preoccupying him in verses 1 to 12. It fills almost his entire vision. This ending of his days, which he's convinced is happening. And it's very evident then which calendar is the dominant one inside his head. It's calendar number one, that very limited calendar, its horizons no wider than the dates of one's own life. That's the calendar that's shaping his outlook. You can see it even just from the frequency of the word I in verses 1 to 12. I, again and again and again. And then you see, with calendar number 1 shaping his outlook, his own mortality obsessing him, he thinks of God's eternity. And what's the effect? Well, the effect is resentment, I think. And bitterness in the heart of the psalmist. That's how we should read verse 12. Verse 12 in the ESV is put with the next section. It goes, I think, with the previous section. Think about this. What do you do if a shiny red Ferrari goes past you as you're driving home from work? Well, I guess if you're remotely into such things, then you admire it. Wow, you say to yourself, that's a nice car. Unless, that is, unless at the moment that it goes past, you are in fact stationary in a lay-by trying to figure out why your old banger of a car has just stopped working. In that case, you're not admiring as that Ferrari goes whizzing past. You're resentful. Your reaction isn't, nice car. It's, oh, you're all right, aren't you, in your swanky supercar. Yes, you just rev your engine like that as you go past and give that delicious roar for us all to hear. I'd be happy if my engine would just make any noise whatsoever at this point. Thank you very much. And that's how the psalmist feels. All those expressions of transience and fragility. Verse 3, my days pass away like smoke. Verse 4, my heart is struck down like grass and has withered. Verse 11, my days are like an evening shadow. I wither away like grass. He's in a lay-by, staring miserably at his old banger of a life as it conks out on him. And as he does so, out of the corner of his eye, he glimpses a shiny red Ferrari, this God whose life is emphatically not conking out on him. He exists eternally, enthroned forever and ever. And it's like a dagger, I'm saying, through the psalmist's heart. But you, O Lord, verse 12, are enthroned forever. You are remembered throughout all generations. I'm fading. I'm unraveling. I'm wasting away, but you... you go on forever. That's how we should read verse 12. There's no admiration or worship in those words. The tone is deeply sardonic. It's the psalmist from his lay-by shouting, well, you're all right, aren't you, God? You're all solid and stable. I could use a bit of your solidity and stability right now as my health and strength rapidly comes apart at the seams. So I hope you're seeing what's going on there in verses 1 to 12. But now let's move into verses 13 to 22. And there you cannot but notice the tone changes completely. That section is as different from verses 1 to 12 as day is from night. Everything is suddenly brighter and happier in verses 13 to 22. It's unrecognizable from what has gone before. How come? Has the psalmist's crisis passed? Well, no, that's not the reason. This is the reason he swaps calendars. Calendar number one is replaced by calendar number two. He starts to think now in terms of God's program of salvation, and the fact then that God's purpose is ultimately to draw into his people the nations of the world. Verse 15, nations will fear the name of the Lord, and all the kings of the earth will fear your glory. Verse 18 refers to a people yet to be created, praising the Lord. That doesn't mean generations yet unborn, although it includes that. But what it really is focusing on is a people that will be so wonderfully ethnically diverse. A people where there was not a people, to use the language of Hosea taken up by the Apostle Peter. And then verse 22, peoples gathering together and kingdoms to worship the Lord. He describes all this in verses 13 and 16 as the favoring and building up of Zion. So God's people is existing, it seems, in the psalmist's day in a very dilapidated, decrepit condition. Things are bad in Zion, in Israel, in the psalmist's day. But God's people then in the future are going to be favored and built up, and favored and built up in this particular way, the nations being incorporated into Zion, into Israel, as the worship of Yahweh spreads around the globe. Indeed, verse 16 even touches briefly on a further point in God's program of salvation beyond the ingathering of the nations. Astonishingly, a personal appearance, the second line of verse 16, a personal appearance of God in his glory. So you can see then how different is the calendar now hanging on the wall of the psalmist's mind. The word I disappears now, doesn't it? And this is the thing then. How does the truth of God's eternity fit in now that he's swapped calendars? We saw how that fitted in verses 1 to 12, how it frustrated him and angered him. But how does the truth of God's eternity fit in now? Is it still that shiny red Ferrari that provokes resentment and bitterness in him? Well, no. It now has a completely different significance. What it means is this. God's eternity means that God does not have to be in a hurry to fulfill his saving purposes. He doesn't have to get it all done as soon as possible before his life ebbs away, because his life isn't going to ebb away. He's eternal. He can fulfill his saving purposes, his program of salvation, at whatever pace he wishes. And therefore, the fact that there's presently no evidence of his saving purposes materializing in the psalmist's day is no argument against those saving purposes finally transpiring. Because in the psalmist's day, there was no evidence. As I said just now, God's people was in a decrepit and dilapidated condition. There was no sign in the psalmist's day of the nations being drawn into God's people. That prospect, indeed, no doubt appeared utterly outlandish. It didn't seem possible. It was so far from where things were at in those days. And it was natural, therefore, to disbelieve God's saving purposes, to disbelieve that they would ever materialize. Why, after all, there's no sign of them now, the psalmist could have said. They're not going to happen. This is all a pipe dream. But in verses 13 to 22, you see the psalmist isn't troubled by such objections. He knows God's eternal. God doesn't have a limited window of time in which he has to do everything. He can gather in the nations later, much further down the line, because he'll still be alive then. He'll still be existing then. He'll still be God. He'll still be on the throne. And so despite the present state of affairs, I'm saying the psalmist is confident. Those great events in God's program of salvation, they will happen, they will occur. That's what he's saying in verse 13, which I think is unfortunately translated rather than "you will arise and have pity on Zion, it is the time to favour her," it should be "you will arise and have pity on Zion, there is a time to favour her." He's not saying it's happening. That's exactly what he's not saying. He's saying that "I see nothing of it yet, but it will happen. There is a time when you will pity Zion." Verses 18 and 19, "let it be recorded for a generation to come that he looked down from his holy height. From heaven, the Lord looked at the earth. He did these things. He brought about his saving purposes." The psalmist is confident that God will do these things, even though there's as yet no sign of them, because God is eternal. And he can do them in his own time, when he wishes, when he pleases. So that's verses 13 to 22. Then, however, in verses 23 and 24, the psalmist has a wobble. And calendar number one resurfaces. And his own mortality becomes again the focus of attention. And once again, God's eternity becomes to him this frustrating thing. So callously impassive in the face of his, the psalmist's, unraveling. "Oh my God," verse 24, "take me not away in the midst of my days, you whose years endure throughout all generations." I think that tone creeps back in to his language again. But the wobble is brief. And he then comes to verses 25 to 28. And here then is the most sustained contemplation yet of God's eternity. One of the most sustained that we have in the Bible, perhaps. And here actually he contrasts God's eternity not only with his own transience and fragility, but even with the creation's transience and fragility. "It is wearing out like a garment," he says in verse 26, compared to this God who endures forever. By the way, it's an interesting counterpoint, I think, to what we talked about last Sunday evening, preaching from 2 Kings. I mentioned the covenant with Noah, you remember, the promise to Noah that there will be order and stability while the earth remains. And I said that's a wonderful and important promise. It's a promise that one day is going to expire, and that's a terrifying prospect for those who are not Christ's. But it's a great promise in itself, and we can rely on it. There will basically be an order and stability about the world until the end, which makes the world inhabitable. However, that's not to say that there will be a consistent level of functionality in this creation right up until the end. This verse is saying there will actually be an increasing dysfunctionality. Not a fatal dysfunctionality, not a dysfunctionality that overturns the promise to Noah, but nonetheless an increasing dysfunctionality because it's wearing out. The creation's wearing out. Perhaps you've gone this past week to your wardrobes to dig out some more wintry clothes, and suddenly you've realized that jumper you hope to wear this winter, it's starting to wear. You hadn't realized there's a hole appearing in it somewhere. And the psalmist is saying the creation's like that. It's accumulating holes. It's wearing out. It's wearing thin. And that's an important factor then, perhaps, in modern environmental debates. I'm sure it may be possible for us human beings to accelerate the decline. But the decline itself is inevitable. That's what Psalm 102 is telling us. It's wearing out like a garment. But anyway, this is the most sustained contemplation of God's eternity. But now you'll notice there's not a hint of frustration in verses 25 to 28. And instead, the stanza comes to that magnificent climax in verse 28. "The children of your servant shall dwell secure. Their offspring shall be established before you." Just another way, I think, of describing the restoration of Zion that he's already talked about in verses 13 to 22. Those purposes of God for the nations to be drawn in, that they shall be fulfilled. And the psalmist is saying at the end, it will definitely happen. And again, then, it's a confidence that is flowing from his understanding of God's eternity. "I don't see it happening now, but that's no big deal. It doesn't have to happen now. An eternal God will do it in his own time." So that's the conviction then in my heading. The psalmist's conviction at the heart of verses 25 to 28 is this: God's eternity means I can be confident regarding his program of salvation, irrespective of what I see right now. That's his conviction. I can be confident that God will do everything in his great plan and purpose of salvation, whether or not I see the signs of it right now. But it's a conviction attained with difficulty. We've seen that, haven't we? The conviction isn't there in verses 1 to 12. It's not there at all at that point. And it seems to evaporate briefly again in verses 23 and 24. This conviction, it's one that's attained with difficulty. And just three very quick applications then here. Application number one, let's seek ourselves to have calendar number 2 in our heads. God's program of salvation. To think in terms of God's dates, God's great salvation events and moments. Remember again that line from Sinclair Ferguson, when that calendar is in my mind, it has a dramatic impact on my life. And then flowing from that, application number 2, let's be confident that what remains within that program of salvation will occur. Will occur. Now, actually, most of it now has, isn't it? And as we said in our prayer, we are privileged to be in these days that the psalmist was looking forward to as such a distant prospect. And we are the nations. We are that people that was yet to be created. We've been created. We are praising Yahweh. And so we're a lot further on now, but not yet everything has happened. Not yet that personal appearing of God, verse 16, in his glory. I think Paul takes up the language of that verse in Titus 2:13 when he refers to the appearing of the glory of our great God and Saviour, Jesus Christ. And you might say, well, you know, Paul does talk a lot about that, but since Paul talked a lot about it, 2,000 years have gone by. And it hasn't happened yet. And there's no sign of it as we look out on the world today. There's no sign that there's going to be this personal, glorious appearing of the Son of God. And our answer then should be the answer that the psalmist reaches at the end of this psalm, that God is eternal. As Peter puts it, 1,000 years is as one day for this God. And so the fact that he hasn't done it yet and there's no sign of him doing yet doesn't remotely mean that it's not going to happen. An eternal God will do it when he pleases. And then application number 3, just getting very kind of nitty gritty practical. I guess this all reminds us that as believers we wobble. We wobble. This conviction that the psalm ends with was not his conviction all the way through, and it sometimes was, and then it went again. Isn't that a realistic picture of the Christian life? And I think sometimes we can feel very guilty about these kinds of wobbles. I mean, I suppose it doesn't happen so much in other areas of life. You think of Robert there studying maths at university, and I guess at a young age, he learnt the 2x table, and then he went on and learnt longer multiplication and longer division and fractions and all that kind of stuff. And now then, studying a maths degree, he doesn't suddenly have these moments of crisis where he thinks, oh, the 2x table, how does that work again? I have to go back and relearn that all over again. It doesn't really happen with maths. But it happens in the Christian life, doesn't it? And you can be just going along with your life, and suddenly, out of nowhere, comes the thought, the resurrection of Christ on that Sunday, did it really happen? And suddenly you're plunged into this crisis, and you have to go back and relearn the truth, and go through all the evidence again, and work through that process, and we can feel guilty. Surely it shouldn't be like that. But I'm saying that's the psalmist's experience here. And he makes all his progress, and then he's back again where he was at the start of the psalm. And I'm not saying that it's desirable to have those wobbles, but I am saying it's normal. That's the normal Christian life, and we shouldn't allow the evil one to give us a false sense of guilt when we experience that kind of thing. So that's the first thing and the main thing, a conviction attained with difficulty. But there's one other thing that we have here. in these verses that we're looking at. A commitment announced with delight. A commitment announced with delight. Back in the summer, you may have seen this. President Biden was delivering a speech and he was using an autocue, as he often does. And suddenly, in the middle of his speech, he said the words, "Repeat that line." And the reason, of course, was that there'd been a bit of a mix-up here, and the words, "Repeat that line," weren't intended to come from Biden. They were intended by the scriptwriter who had devised that autocue for Biden. Not to come from him, they were intended for him. Now, our text is quoted in the New Testament. Some of you will have already appreciated that. In Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 to 12. And yet, we appear to have in Hebrews chapter 1 a similar kind of mix-up. Because this writer to the Hebrews, he has God speaking these words. And you feel like saying, no, what are you talking about, writer to the Hebrews? These words weren't intended to come from God. They were intended by the psalmist for God. He was speaking them to God. These aren't words from God. But of course, we don't have the right, do we, as evangelical Christians with a high view of Scripture, we don't have the right to tut-tut like that and dismiss the writer to the Hebrews as a bit of a numpty. We must trust what he's doing here, and we must trust then that there is a second and proper way of reading verses 25 to 28, whereby God is speaking. And not only that, but God is speaking actually to his Son, Jesus Christ. And I said then that that is a second proper way of reading the psalm, not just verses 25 to 28. Because I think actually that to make sense then of that conclusion, that in verses 25 to 28, God is in fact speaking these words to Christ, you then have to re-understand everything that has preceded those final verses. You have to re-understand verses 1 to 24 as well. And indeed, you have to arrive, I think, working back, as I say, from Hebrews 1 and this second way of understanding the psalm, you have to arrive at this conclusion that verses 1 to 24 of the psalm are Christ speaking to God. More than that, Christ speaking to God in the midst of his sufferings, as we can put it as New Testament Christians, at the cross. Christ speaking to God at the cross. I mean, that works, doesn't it? As an understanding of verses 1 to 24. Let's go through some of those verses again in that light. I mean, truly the cross was for Christ the day of his distress, verse 2. Truly Christ groaned at the cross and experienced his bones clinging to his flesh, verse 5. Truly Christ was taunted by enemies at the cross, verse 8. Truly, Christ's strength, verse 23, was broken in mid-course at the cross. This is a man in his early 30s who's suffering and dying in that way. Indeed, there are perhaps other touches in the psalm which make more sense spoken by Christ than by the psalmist. Verse 2, "Do not hide your face from me." What did we sing earlier on about the cross? The Father turns his face away. Verse 10, "Because of your indignation and anger, you have taken me up and thrown me down." Very violent language. But you and I need to appreciate that is what Christ was experiencing from his Father at the cross. That's what we need to appreciate as we eat this bread in a few minutes and drink the wine, that the event we are commemorating was nothing less than Christ experiencing the outpoured indignation and anger of his Father who was taking him up and throwing him down. But let's think about verse 24 then in terms of Christ. "Oh my God, I say, take me not away in the midst of my days." And again, You can align that, can't you, with Christ's experience in Gethsemane? What is his prayer there? Don't let this happen. I don't want to drink this cup. Don't take me away in the midst of my days. Don't let me die. And of course, in Christ's case, God did not comply with that request. However, he did something better than that. After Christ's death, after Christ was cut short in the midst of his days, God raised him from death and exalted him to heaven's heights. And that, I think, lies unspoken between verses 24 and 25. Christ being raised and Christ being exalted to the highest place. And it's then, having raised Christ and having exalted Christ, that God speaks to Christ the words of verses 25 to 28. I mean, pretty much all those quotes in Hebrews 1 relate to that point. When Christ has been raised and exalted, certainly the quotes on either side of the Psalm 102 quote relate precisely to that. So the writer to the Hebrews quotes in verses 8 and 9 from Psalm 45, and it's about Christ being enthroned. And then verse 13 quotes from Psalm 110, and it's about Christ again being enthroned so that his enemies will be made a footstool for his feet. These quotes, they're pointing to that moment. When Christ, the Messiah, has been raised and exalted and enthroned. And those quotes then, those other quotes, they are suffused with delight, aren't they? It's as though God is saying in Psalm 45 and in Psalm 110, I'm so pleased with you, son. So delighted with your obedience, with the way that you fulfilled your mission and suffered for your people. Now enjoy your throne and enjoy your enemies being subjected to you. And I'm saying then that Psalm 102, verses 25 to 28 are in exactly the same spirit. And what we have there similarly is a commitment announced with delight by the Father to his Son. He's committing to certain things. He's saying, Son, never again will you experience what you experience at the cross. Never again will you evaporate like smoke. Never again will you fade like a shadow. Never again will you wither like dry grass. Never again will you experience that kind of transience and ephemerality and flimsiness and impermanence. Everything else will, son. The whole creation will wear out like a garment, but you won't. In fact, you will be there to preside over the creation's very dismantling. As you were involved at the beginning of creation, you, son, will also be involved at the end. You're the one who will change the heavens and the earth like a robe, but you will always remain. Your years have no end from this point on. I'm saying, these words are, in the last analysis, the promise of a proud father, awed by his son's endurance of his sufferings. And the climax is verse 28. And there, he's even saying this. He's saying, those servants of yours, son, for whom you were suffering, though during their lives on earth they often themselves feel so transient and fragile and impermanent, I am going to do the same to them that I'm now doing to you. I will one day raise and exalt them too, so that no longer will they be shadow-like and smoke-like and dry grass-like, but rather secure, that's the word he uses there. Establish, that's the other word he uses there. Establish indeed before you, that is in your very presence, son. Isn't that wonderful? Do you feel feeble this morning? Do you feel weak this morning? Do you feel you're unraveling this morning? Do you feel like the tent in our song in 2 Corinthians 5, flapping with every gust of ill health and accident and injury? Well, God has delightedly made a commitment to his Son that you one day will dwell sturdily, robustly, securely in his son's very presence. Perhaps we can reverently imagine Christ as he takes his throne there at that moment, following his sufferings, following his ascension. And the Father says, "That there's your throne, son. Now, is there anything else you'd like? Is there anything else I can do for you? Just tell me, ask anything, and I will do it for you, son. I'm so proud of you. I'm so pleased with you." And he says, "Well, Father, I want my people here as well. I don't want to be here eternally without them. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am to see my glory," John 17:24. "I want them here where I am, in the same form that I'm now in, secure, no longer flimsy and frail." And the Father says, "That's no problem, son. They shall all be here. I'll get them all here. I'll establish them all before you in your presence." And he says, "Father, well, don't forget that one in Benton. Don't forget that one in Gateshead. I want every single one of them." And he says, "Son, every single one of them." And so we can be assured this morning that, borne along by that commitment of the Father to his Son, come what may, we shall make it into the final presence of Christ in resurrection splendor. Amen.